Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. It was on this very day back in 1930 that Hoagy Carmichael recorded Georgia on My Mind. In which year did this song become the official state song of Georgia? Was that A, 1932, B, 1946, C, 1961, or D, 1979? Hint, here's Ray Charles's 1960 recording of this song.
I sing for my Georgia.
So, which year did this song become the official state song of Georgia?
Get it home and through. This old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
And question number two, it was on this day back in which year that Enrico Caruso recorded his last work for Victor Records. As noted in Encyclopedia Britannica, Caruso became the most celebrated and highest paid of his contemporaries worldwide. He made recordings of about 200 operatic excerpts and songs. Many of them are still being published. His voice was sensuous, lyrical, and vigorous in dramatic outbursts, and became progressively darker in timbre in his later years. So, which year did this famous singer make his last recording? Was that A, 1905, B, 1920, C, 1935, or D, 1950? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of September the 14th. Well, it was on this day back in 1814 that Francis Scott Key wrote the lyrics to the Star Spangled Banner. The song became the official U.S. national anthem on March the 3rd, 1931. And it was 115 years ago today, 1903, that Roy Acuff was born. He was the first living artist to be elected into the Country Music Hall of Fame, 1903 today. And in country music news, we have this. Cowboy Junkies, their new album, All That Reckoning. It's given 3 out of a possible 4 stars, and the review is published in The Week magazine on the 3rd of August, 2018. 30 years after recording their breakthrough album, The Trinity Session, Cowboy Junkies are still tapping into the dark heart of country music in a most intriguing way, said Will Hodgkinson in The Times, UK. The Canadian band, led by siblings Michael and Margot Timmins, sounds newly inspired by the confluence of Middle Ages onset and today's gloomy global politics. Low-key despair has always been the group's best mode, and because All That Reckoning offers no shortage of dread, it's also the Junkies' most vital album in years. Because a fusion of alt-country and narcotized rock is an enduring signature, sonically this could be the group's third album or its 20th, said Hal Horowitz in AmericanSongwriter.com. Still, these songs have hooks, melodies, and arrangements that subtly grab listeners as Margot aims her distinctive hushed croon at disappointing lovers and bigoted political leaders alike. Here's hoping new listeners discover Cowboy Junkies this time, because their talents show no sign of dissipating. And in classical music news, we have this article entitled, Motoring Madness, the Stupidest Things Drivers Have Done Behind the Wheel Revealed, including playing the trumpet. Dan Elson's the writer, and it's published in thesun.co.uk on the 22nd of August, 2018. We've all seen motorists doing some pretty stupid things on the road, from failing to indicate to hogging the middle lane on the motorway. Some drivers need to brush up on their road laws, but these motorists push the limits even further, trying to busy themselves with other tasks while behind the wheel. Putting on makeup, eating, even playing the trumpet are all reckless things real road users have done and could have landed them a careless or even dangerous driving charge. So which of these cases of distracted driving do you think is the worst? The article then produces about 10 pictures of various offenses shown, including readers, drinkers, multitaskers, eaters, and so on, at least two of which were trumpet-playing drivers, with these captions. Number one, brass instruments and highways don't tend to mix. And number two, is he trying to steer the car with his music? So remember, no matter how classical your music is, don't toot your horn while driving. Alan Toussaint's cover of Ellington's Solitude introduces our jazz music news. It's an article entitled, A Lifetime of Carla Bley, published in The New Yorker. Ethan Iverson, the writer, published on the 13th of May, 2018. Every jazz fan knows the name of Carla Bley, but her relentless productivity and constant reinvention can make it difficult to grasp her contribution to music. I began listening to her in high school when I was enamored with the pianist Paul Bley, whose seminal 1960s LPs were filled with Carla Bley compositions. The two were married. In the last half decade, many of Bley's remaining peers from the early years have died. At 82, Bley is still composing and practicing the piano every day, but it also felt like it was high time to rent a car, visit a hero, and try to get a few stories on the official record. Bley lives in an upstate compound tucked away near Willow, New York. Bley's upstairs study is stocked with hundreds of her scores and an upright piano, on which she played me her latest opus, a sour ballad a bit in the monk tradition, with just enough unusual crinkling in the corners to prevent it from being too square. When we sat down to talk, Bley proved to be witty and surreal, just like her music. I asked her about Count Basie in the late 1950s. Count Basie was playing at Birdland, Basin Street, and the Jazz Gallery when I was working as a cigarette girl, she said. I got to hear him more than anyone else, and it was an education. Basie is still her favorite pianist. He's the final arbiter of how to play two notes. The distance and volume between two notes is always perfect. Bley was a radical, but she also sought structure. She told me about the early 60s avant-garde. In free playing, everybody played as loud as they could, and as fast as they could, and as high as they could. I liked them, but I think the music needed a setting. I thought free jazz needed work. A watershed was Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by the Beatles, a suite of songs that form a bigger picture. An artist friend of mine came over one day with his album, Bley told me. He said, "Jazz is dead. All the artists are listening to this. We don't listen to jazz anymore. This is it." In addition to the Beatles, Bley told me about loving American music like bluegrass and gospel. For an avant-garde composer, rock, bluegrass, and gospel are easy meat when making a mashup. When Carla was ready to work on a large-scale project of her own, the result was one of the biggest unified compositions jazz has ever produced, kind of surreal jazz opera, Escalator Over the Hill. The long, stylistically eclectic work fuses singers and players from all over the musical map. 53 individuals participated in the recording, including some of the most productive and original jazz and rock musicians working at the time. And the work is perhaps the quintessential anti-establishment statement of its time. In recent decades, Bley's own piano is finally being heard in an exposed context. Probably nobody else in jazz began practicing the piano at such a late date in their career. "I do the 51 Brahms exercises every day," Bley said. However, her jazz pianicism is not a virtuoso, European quotation, but a dry and lean thunk in the tradition of Thelonious Monk. Romantic Notions No. 3 from 1988 sounds like she tipped Ellington's Prelude to a Kiss on its side and found whatever bits were left in the box. The title of her latest album, Andando el Tiempo, means with the passing of time. At the end of our interview, Bley said, "That was very interesting, thinking of all those people in the past. As I drove home, I listened to Bley's most recent big band writing, Time/Life, released after Charlie Hayden's death. The title track is especially moving. A lonely chorale, backed by a marching snare drum, gives way to a brilliant saxophone solo. Bley said, "Those people in the past," but her work lights the way for those working to join the past to the future. And in music research and technology, we have this article entitled, "Indigenous Musicians Are in the Spotlight in Canada. From British Columbia to Nunavut, How the Indigenous Music Scene is Producing Genre-Spanning Sounds and New Opportunities for Cultural Understanding." This is written by Katie Bain, published in NewYorker.com on the 15th of June, 2018. In 1995, Leonard Sumner had never been to a nightclub. His community, the Little Saskatchewan First Nation in Manitoba, was light years away from glossy big city nightlife. The area was surrounded by rolling plains, thick forest, and vast freshwater lakes. There weren't any nightclubs. There wasn't even a record store. Obsessed with the hip-hop exploding out of New York and Los Angeles in this era, the then-adolescent Sumner wanted to be like his rap idols. He could rhyme and write music, but his lyrics about clubbing and money felt bogus. His life on the reservation is very different from those of the platinum-selling artist popping bottles south of the Canadian border. But as he got deeper into his craft, Sumner realized he could emulate his influences simply by telling his own story with the same vivid honesty with which they were proclaiming theirs. He sat down to write about his world and found the lyrics flowed easily and in abundance. With the shift, he was making music connected not only to hip-hop, but also to his own ancestors. Indigenous people, we've always been storytellers since we've had language, Sumner says. There's been this image of the Hollywood Indian that's made us out to be stoic people, incapable of emotion. I didn't feel that, and I was sick of other people telling our stories. I knew my story was valid and that I was capable of telling it. Sumner immersed himself in music, releasing his debut album, Res Poetry, in 2013. Lyrics about life, death, hope, dreams, addiction, and the northern lights of his homeland weren't all happy, but they were honest, and they were his. The album's success led to Sumner playing major music festivals throughout Canada, which helped establish him as a key player in the country's indigenous music scene. From the pristine glaciers of Nunavut to the towering mountains of British Columbia, Indigenous musicians are in the midst of a renaissance in the new wave of artists reclaim their histories and collectively redefine what Indigenous artist even means. These singers, instrumentalists, beat makers, and curators are creating and sharing music that celebrates thousands of years of cultural heritage through styles both traditional and innovative. This music addresses the challenging history Indigenous peoples have with Canada while celebrating the resilience of their cultures. Through music, Indigenous musicians are educating audiences and fostering cross-cultural understanding. This is not just entertainment, it's revolution. Indigenous singers incorporate traditional Inuk throat singing, intensive and transportive. Throat singing is meant to emulate the sounds of nature, animal calls, thunder crashing, waves, and is thus intimately connected to Nunavut and the people who have called it home for millennia. The tradition was almost wiped out when missionaries arrived. As the tradition has been resurrected, so too has it evolved. Inuk throat singing icon Tanya Tagak has performed with symphonies, electronic acts, and rock bands around the world. In 2015, two adolescent throat singers stole the show when they performed at Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's 2015 swearing-in ceremony. Jarrett Martineau is the founder of Toronto-based Indigenous music platform and record label Revolutions Per Minute, and hosts a CBC radio program, Reclaimed. The show features music from different genres, eras, and Indigenous cultures worldwide. While it was a major victory when the Juno Awards, Canada's version of the Grammys, added the Indigenous Music Album of the Year category in 1994, many artists who fell in that category now just want to be judged by the same criteria as everyone else. In the aftermath of colonialism, musicians are reinvigorating their communities, traditions, and messages. This awakening is fostered by the exceptional depth and beauty in Indigenous art forms, from the precise choreography of powwow dancing to the hypnotic rhythm of the drums, to the layers of meaning held in many songs and performances. And as new styles and traditions emerge and spread, the magnitude of this awakening grows. Together, we must acknowledge that all of these stories are a part of our collective truth in Canada. The article skips down and ends with this. The most important thing is telling the truth about your existence and your story, says Sumner, whose latest album, Standing in the Light, addresses prayer, faith, forgiveness, healing, corruption, broken treaties, and the water that flooded the reservation on which he first dreamed of becoming a successful musician. People recognize that truth, he says, and they gravitate towards it.
So I
Dodd Rundgren's 1972 hit, I Saw the Light, introduces our rock and pop music news. It's an article entitled Dodd Rundgren, and is published in Rolling Stone magazine on the 24th of August, 2017. Rundgren just released White Knight, his 27th solo album, and is touring with Ringo Starr's All-Star Band. These are songs that are classic for the Resistance. First of all, The Fix, who sang Stand or Fall. This is about what's happening to the planet and how doing nothing is to lose. It has a bleak sound, which adds urgency. And then there's Red Ryder's Lunatic Fringe, the undercurrent of violence and hate, as evidenced by the election of Trump, makes this an evergreen song. But now the Lunatic Fringe is no longer the fringe. And then there's The Calls, The Walls Came Down. This became an anthem about having a party and fighting the powers that be. It's got this great celebratory hoot at the end. Then there's Elvis Costello and The Attractions. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? He's angry that people aren't taking this stuff seriously, as in, what's so funny? It makes you want to march. And then finally, the Sex Pistols' God Save the Queen. They weren't protesting the Queen so much as Thatcherite England. It fostered a movement that carried forward. Once again, these are classic songs for the Resistance. Ed King's voice and his guitar introduces Lynyrd Skynyrd's Sweet Home Alabama for our local music news. It's an article written by David Manconi, published in the News and Observer on the 25th of August, 2018, entitled Ed King, 1949 to 2018, Guitarist Played in North Carolina with Lynyrd Skynyrd. Former Lynyrd Skynyrd guitarist Ed King died this week of cancer at age 68, and obituaries noted his contributions to Skynyrd classics such as Sweet Home Alabama. They also took note of King's time in the band Strawberry Alarm Clock, for whom he co-wrote the 1967 number one hit Incense and Peppermints. After King switched from bass to guitar, his slide guitar leads became a Skynyrd signature on songs like 1974's The Ballad of Curtis Lowe. That's also his voice on the introductory countdown at the beginning of Sweet Home Alabama. King spent a tumultuous few years in Skynyrd before leaving in 75, 2 years before the plane crash that killed three members, including frontman Ronnie Van Zant. He was inducted along with the rest of the band into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2006. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was on this very day back in 1930 that Hoagy Carmichael recorded Georgia on My Mind. In which year did that song become the official state song of Georgia? Was it A, 1932, B, 1946, C, 1961, or D, 1979? Correct answer. Answer D, 1979. As noted on August the 14th, 2015, FT.com, Financial Times, the languid, almost sensuous lyric of Georgia on My Mind could be as easily about a lover as the southern U.S. state, the 1930 song celebrates. Indiana Ray's Carmichael had never set foot in Georgia when he composed the tune. Carmichael, who ended up acting and writing music for the TV Western series Laramie, once told Downbeat magazine, "After rock and roll started, I never even got a phone call from an A&R man about anything." But in 1960, the song's fortunes changed. Rising star Ray Charles' first LP for his new label, ABC Paramount, was The Genius Hits the Road, a 12-track concept album fit themed on places in the U.S. The single Georgia on My Mind reached number one in 1960 and won a Grammy Award. Charles's performance wrung every ounce out of the song's yearning for home theme, yet according to his 1978 autobiography, Brother Ray, neither woman nor state were on his mind when he recorded the song. I've never known a lady named Georgia, and I wasn't dreaming of the state, even though I was born there, he said. It was just a beautiful romantic melody. That didn't stop Georgia on My Mind becoming so indelibly linked to the southern state that in 1979, the relationship was formalized when the Georgia House of Representatives declared it the official state song. Charles's 1960 hit ushered in a plethora of covers, including Willie Nelson, who had a substantial hit with it when he topped Billboard's Country and Western chart in 1978 and won the song a second Grammy. And the answer to our second question, it was on this day back in which year that Enrico Caruso recorded his last work for Victor Records. As noted in Encyclopedia Britannica in a July 29, 2018 entry, Caruso became the most celebrated and highest paid of his contemporaries worldwide. He made recordings of about 200 operatic excerpts and songs. So, was his last recording in A, 1905, B, 1920, C, 1935, or D, 1950? Correct answer B, 1920. Encyclopedia Britannica adds, Enrico Caruso, who died in 1921, last recording, 1921, Caruso, one of the first musicians to document his voice on recordings. He received no formal music training until age 18. 3 years later, he made his operatic debut in Naples. World recognition came in the spring of 1902 after he sang in La Boheme at Monte Carlo and in Rigoletto at London's Covent Garden. He made his American debut in Rigoletto at the opening night of the Metropolitan Opera in New York City on November 23, 1903, and continued to open each season there for the next 17 years. His last public appearance, his 607th, was with the Metropolitan Opera on Christmas Eve, 1920. So let's close out today's program with Caruso's Dreams of Long Ago from 1912. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me. Randy Thompson at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.